Well, many hunters in Wisconsin have put away their rifles and shotguns for another season, so it seems like a good time to reflect on past seasons and ask yourself, why do I hunt the way I do? Or do I even hunt at all? And why do I or do I not? Some of those questions are answered in the book titled The Hunter, Developmental Stages and Ethics. The author is Bob Norton. Larry Mueller here, and Bob's my guest now. He's from Onalaska, Wisconsin, retired psychology professor from UW La Crosse. And he and his colleague, Bob Jackson, worked for probably 25 years, conducted research on hunters and some on non-hunters as well. And the results are published in this book, The Hunter. It's published by Riverbend Publishing, Helena, Montana. And I'm really pleased to have Bob Norton with me today. And I'm certainly inviting your questions and comments as we move along from both hunters or non-hunters today. As we visit with Bob, you have some questions. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Bob Norton, welcome. Nice to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
25 years, that's a long time to study hunters. You're a hunter yourself.
Oh, yeah, I live to hunt. It's certainly one of the prime motivators in my world, and in a large sense, Larry, kind of a significant part of who I am, which I think is so true of so many dedicated hunters.
And that, in a way, I think that must have made the research that you've done over the years with Bob Jackson. Bob, of course, passed on here a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
So much fun and rewarding.
Right. Yeah. How could you get a better job than to be able to teach at the university and be able to do research dealing with what is so important to your own life? Yeah. It was a privilege to do it, and it was certainly a privilege to work with Bob Jackson. Dedicated sportsman, just an unbelievable researcher. I learned a lot from him, both as a hunter and as a researcher.
And I think one of the significant findings or things that you came up with over the years had to do with stages that many hunters go through, and most hunters go through, certainly. If not, you have five stages, and certainly most hunters go through several of those stages. Right. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Right. The research itself was broken into three aspects, and we were doing it for U.S. Fish and Wildlife and for the Wisconsin DNR. They were the supporters, the financial supporters, through Pittman-Robertson funds. And one part of the study dealt with motivation. Why in the world does hunting become such a significant part of who we are when we are hunters? And in that aspect of it, we tried to find out just what it is that, again, causes us to go out in the woods in a cold morning and sit in a tree all day or out in a marsh or whatever it happens to be. And as we dealt with hunters and interviewed hunters, we could begin to see as they talked to us that a number of them had started at one place in their hunting career, and now we're at a very different place. That's what basically kind of keyed us into the fact that there's movement as a person hunts. And all of a sudden we began to realize, well, what it is it's a broadening of what is satisfying to them. They start fairly narrow, and then as they progress through these stages, it becomes a more complete. And it was very fascinating. Once we sort of figured that out, then we asked hunters, of course, directly about it, and they were just ready to share it. They wanted to talk about it.
Well, we have five stages. There's a shooter stage. That's kind of the first stage.
Right.
A limiting out hunter stage.
Right.
Trophy hunter stage. The method hunting stage. And then the sportsman stage is kind of the last stage.
Yes, yeah.
What's the difference? Well, give us, before we go to the phones, give us a little thumbnail on each of these stages.
Okay. What we found out is that in the very beginning, when people first start to hunt, and this was true of first-time hunters, and interestingly enough, even some of the hunters who had been in the woods for a number of years, just the scene of game and the excitement and what it does to our heartbeats, and all of us who hunt realize what it does to our heartbeat, the excitement of seeing game, and that was actually satisfying enough. I can personalize that just a little bit. I went to high school up in northern Wisconsin and had a peer group, of course, of hunters. And when we came to school during the rifle season, during the grouse season, during the duck season, whatever it was, Monday morning we got together, and what was the first thing we talked about? Not how many we had gotten, how many we'd seen.
How many you'd seen.
How many we'd seen. Yeah, and that second phase is, as we found out what happens, is it's basically the beginning of really the skilled hunter. And as the skilled hunter begins to develop those skills of knowing the relationships between habitat, animal behavior, all of those kinds of things, they start becoming able to harvest. Mm-hmm. And so that second stage really deals with the beginning of the harvest of the animal. Shooting skills are there. Handling of the gun starts coming. So when they walk through the woods, they're looking for the game. They're not looking at the gun. They're looking mm-hmm. at their feet. And so it's a skills, it's that first beginning skill level. And then they get to the point where they begin to not just, and they know they can harvest in that second phase. They're starting to get animals. They're starting to bring animals home. Harvest becomes an integral part. And then all of a sudden they realize that I'm good enough to get game, and because I know I can go out and harvest game, now I'm going to start becoming selective. So I'm going to add a little bit to my hunting experience, which is really a little bit perfection in the sense that I really have to become better at what I'm doing, because what I need to do is maybe get a limit of greenheads instead of just a limit of ducks, mm-hmm. the trophy whitetail. And then, Larry, the most interesting part that we thought happens is that there's actually a psychological flip over as they move into that fourth stage. We called it the method stage. And really what it is all of a sudden harvest starts becoming less and less significant, and the whole concept of the hunt starts becoming much more prevalent. And oftentimes the hunters at this stage begin to handicap themselves. Mm-hmm. So the rifle hunter still rifle hunts, but he adds black powder, or he mm-hmm. adds the bow to his mm-hmm. repertoire. And it's really interesting when we talk to the hunters who are at this fourth stage. One of the things that we realized is that they had become really very, very aware of the environment that they were in. Mm-hmm. Those first three stages, they were so intent on getting animals, of harvesting, that they didn't really spend time to really look that area over, right, and really understand what they were and the privilege they had to be in the woods. Oftentimes, the hunter had hunted long enough, maybe had a son or daughter who was starting to hunt. And then they're starting to bring their son or daughter into the sport. And then that fifth stage, very few. I think we estimated about 5% of the hunters actually get to that fifth stage. But there, the hunt is so significant to them, but the harvest is no longer necessary. I talked to a guy this over Christmas vacation. Been hunting for somewhere around 55 years, been hunting whitetails. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And what he told me, he hunted the first 3 days of the rifle season, loved it, out in his tree, saw two does, but they really were more beautiful alive than dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he didn't shoot one of them. Yet I said to him, but Bill, you know, does this really, what does this really mean? You know, and he said, it's hunting that got me there. Mm-hmm. See, it's hunting that got me up there, up in that tree. And it was that whole world, he said, the snow, he said, it's mm-hmm. just everything, yeah. So those are kind of a thumbnail sketch of those stages.
Well, I want to give our callers a chance to visit with you.
Right.
And
right.
Let me give the number again. It's 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. Bill in Orfordville has been waiting. Bill, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Good morning. Wonderful topic. As a lifelong hunter, not so much in recent years, I sort of can see the stages that this gentleman's talking about in my own experiences. You know, I've gotten to the point now where it's much more enjoyable to go out there and just hunt and not kill.
Yeah,
and to do all the things. The other thing I try not to do is buy all the gadgetry. I try to be as close to the Native American as I can in my habits and things, and get the joy out of all of that. But I just find it, in my advancing years here, just very difficult to do the kill.
Yeah. Interesting, Bill, and I think you really touch on something, and that's the commercialization of hunting and what that could do in, I believe, in a destructive way to the future of hunting. To hunt and to be able to hunt the animal, respect the animal, and take the animal in its own natural environment is what hunting, to me, is all about.
Agree.
Yeah, and so I really appreciate your thoughtfulness on that particular point.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it, Bill. Jim and Ashland, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Bob, I'm glad you're hitting this topic here. I'm a big game guide in the state of Montana, and I find hunting at different points. You know, I'm actually at the age of 59. I'm actually more into hunting than probably ever been important at any point in my life. At one point, I kind of gave it up. I was invited on a whale hunting crew in Alaska, and I seen such amazing amount of waste up there, particularly on walruses. With ivory we just take for the tusk, and that kind of turned me off to hunting for a while. And then I got back and did a kayak trip on the Amazon and got back into butterfly collecting, got me back into hunting.
I can hear the cycle.
But, you know, the thing that really I see is probably the biggest threat to hunting in being a guide. I mean, I put my foot in my mouth there. But it's not the antis as much as the outfitters themselves. For instance, I cannot hunt any wilderness area in Wyoming without a guide. I cannot hunt Alaska, Dall sheep, the grizzly, or a mountain goat without a guide. No province in Canada I can hunt without a guide. So I see the sport not just commercializing, but that's taken away. But I think the some of the people you think that would support the sport is it getting to be a rich man's game.
And I think again, Jimmy, you've hit the nail right on the head. I really think as the hunting fraternity, all of us who hunt, we're at a point where we really need to become aware of some of the issues that's facing hunting right now, and that is a very significant one that you talk about. Is the fact that it's getting to the point where it's going to be a sport ultimately for just those who are wealthy. And then what does the sport mean? And I'm afraid that it's going to mean pay the money to shoot a trophy head to be able to put in your office or whatever it happens to be. And we're going to lose the traditions of hunting. And they are so significant to us as people. So I can hear you. I really can.
It's interesting. I was even looking this week in Mongolia under IBEC. So I called the embassy down there to see what it took to get a tag. And they said, well, the tags were never available to any common man at all. They were all auctioned off, basically, the biggest outfitter out there. So it's just like, you know, so I hunt in northern Wisconsin for whitetails, you know, or even in Wisconsin, your chance of getting a bear tag is like once every 6-7 years. I mean, it's no longer being available to the common man anymore.
Right. Yeah. There's a guy by the name of Jim Posterwitz who writes books on hunting ethics and dealing with the hunter ethics. And in there, Jim, he talks about the tradition of the American hunter and the movement of conservation with the concept that the animal is available to all of us. Nobody owns that animal. And somehow we're losing the ability to be able to basically operate on that principle, to be able to be hunters and not have to go for pay to hunt or and let it become a privilege. So, yeah, there's a great big issue here. And somehow we hunters are going to have to come to grips with it and deal with it.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Bob Norton, our guest today. Bob is the author of the book The Hunter, Developmental Stages and Ethics, and we'll get into that ethics business with him as well as we talk. He writes very eloquently about it. The book is published by Riverbend Publishing in Helena, Montana. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today with Bob Norton about his book titled The Hunter, Developmental Stages and Ethics. Pleased to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, so we'll go right back to the phones. And Tony in Star Prairie is next. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I find it fascinating. I find myself that I've went through these stages of hunting, and I find myself between the fourth and fifth stage at 38 years old. And I would rather just go out, and there's nothing more rewarding for me to go out and just watch the wildlife. And if I am lucky enough and have the opportunity to harvest an animal, that's great, but it's really not that important to me. And I wonder if you're finding more and more of that, at what age you're finding it. As I mentioned, I'm 38. I started deer hunting when I was 12. And I find myself, I went through all those stages, and like I said, find myself between that fourth and fifth stage. I wonder if you're seeing more of that, at what age you're seeing it at.
Interesting.
We delved into that question over and over again. Bob and I used to talk for hours, sat there trying to figure out what is it that causes us to move from one stage to the next. And I should mention here, I think when we originally started to do the research and when we discovered this and then when we started to write and work with sportsman groups and DNRs dealing with this issue, we presented it as though it were you were at one stage, then the next stage, and it was a very sequential thing. It's actually an accumulative factor. In other words, when you're at, as you say, you're between four and stage four and five, you're probably even beginning to become a little bit more sensitive, a little bit more excited just to see game. Than
Absolutely.
You, yes, yeah. So it's a developmental process, but at the same time, it's an accumulative process. And I just got to be honest with you. We never could figure out what really caused a person to go from those stages to the next stages. Some guys did it. Some guys had to shoot 50 whitetails before they got into that fourth stage. Some guys, one guy we interviewed had only hunted 10 years, had not shot a single deer. And as we listened to him talk about his satisfactions and why he hunted and what he got from the hunt, he was obviously at stage four.
Yep.
So, yeah, so I can't answer your question. I really don't know the answer to that.
All right. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Dave in Augusta is next, I believe. Let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm 50 years old, and I've been a deer hunter when I started about maybe 13 or 14. Back then, in the early 70s, it was easy to find a deer hunting spot or property to hunt through neighbors or friends or relatives.
Right.
But as it got into the 70s, toward the middle of the 70s, late 70s, it was even tougher then. We got discouraged, although we did finally go and find some good deer hunting spots and a public hunting grounds. The amount of people... and the incidents that happened with people shooting near us and things like that just kind of turned us off on the whole thing. Now that I'm older, my father's passed away, who was my best hunting buddy. I do have property in northern Wisconsin now, and I find, just like your previous callers, I'm more satisfied with going out there without a gun and just enjoying nature. Maybe it's getting older. You know, but I heard about your stages. I think I'm into that stage now where it's more relaxing to me to not to put up with any pressure of going out and killing something that I find that I like to watch instead of bringing it home and putting it on the table.
Yeah.
It's maybe it's more of a mellowing out with age. But also another comment, during the past couple political presidential campaigns, we found that I feel that it's more a conservative Republican deal to be a hunter as compared to being a Democrat and being a hunter. Have you found that the hunting has got into the political arena?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's in the political arena. I'm not a political scientist, so I'm going to have a real difficult time trying to really put this on there. But I think the thing we have to realize is that there's a high probability it's going to become more political than it's going to become less political of the past.
Right.
Because
I
think what's happening, and you hit on it again, a really significant part of this whole hunting world that we at one time had available to us, Right. And is starting to shrink very, very quickly. And that's right. And that's the fact of, can we find a place to hunt? And it was real interesting when we did a lot of satisfaction scales with the hunters. And we've shared this from and talked with, you know, roughly 5,000 hunters over 25 years. So we got a large database. And when we asked them what was the most dissatisfying experience that you've had as a hunter, it was really interesting because it almost always dealt with the behavior of another hunter.
Right.
And then when we talked about, well, what was that? It most often happened in a situation where there was a crowded situation.
Right.
For duck hunters, it was on the firing lines. For rifle hunters, for rifle hunters, it was when they were in public hunting land, you know, and there were more hunters per square mile than there were certainly deer.
Right.
Yeah. And so we really have to, again, look at that issue, and hopefully the states will be politically wise and get more and more opportunity for the hunter to have land to hunt on.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Thanks,
yeah.
Dave.
Yep, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Paul in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Thank you very much. I wanted to address the ethical question.
Yes, you bet.
From a Native American and a Christian perspective, and the idea of stewardship amongst the Christians, that concept that we are stewards of the earth. Native Americans would say, well, the earth does not belong to us, but we are, you know, part of the earth. And there also there's those ethical questions of thou shalt not kill. But as far as in the natural progression, as man has civilized, quote-unquote, these lands, that there has been elimination of some natural predators for these herds. So when we look at stewardship and the issue of ultimate biodiversity and the health of the forest and these lands, so things are do have a balance that has been disrupted by humans. But where is the hunter's community that responsibility to help maintain a healthy biodiversity that many of the plant species that might be consumed by too large of a herd or not? You know, these ethical questions. How does a hunter serve the well-being of the natural balance, and not necessarily trying to harvest for themselves, but really serving a cause that needs to be addressed, and possibly more education amongst the hunting community to ennoble what they're doing as far as serving us all.
I think what you're getting at is very interesting. I wished I had a chance sometime to sit down and talk with you and really explore your thought. I think you're talking again about that evolutionary process that happens to the hunter as they move into that fourth and fifth stage of their development. It's at that point that they really become aware of and sort of become sensitive to the fact that they are the environment that they're in. That environment is an integral part of who they are. They're not better than it is, or they're not any worse than it is, they're part of it. And I find when I have an opportunity to talk with hunters who have reached that personal understanding of themselves, they are very much a steward of the environment. And they are very much connected to it in almost a personal way. You talk about the Native American traditions and thoughts. I think the hunter can get there. But I'll be real honest with you right now. I think we need to help them get there, and that's another world we need to explore in much more depth than I think that we basically have.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Robert in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Rob. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, and thank you for having my call.
Sure.
I have a comment and a brief question. I do not hunt myself. My grandfather and my family came from Eagle River, which is a very good hunting community, and he taught us, he was a logger and a trapper and a hunter, and he taught us all the respect of the North Woods and how to hunt and how to respect the outdoors. And a lot of us I believe are would be up there in the stages at least three or four. Now, since I don't hunt, I can relate this to fishing since I fish a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since I do a lot of fishing, I mean, some of the best days fishing that I have ever had, I haven't caught a thing.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to the point where I'm practicing catch and release a lot more. Now, my question is, have you ever thought about crossing these two and relating hunting to fishing since it's almost the same, or
yeah,
how these relate to one another?
Yeah, good question, too.
One of the things that happened back in the 70s, I think Bryant was his name, came up with a theory that trout fishermen particularly go through these somewhat same stages as we're talking about right now. And so I think there are some connections. I'm addicted to muskie fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I live to muskie fish. I've been doing it for 50 years, and I haven't figured them out yet. And so the challenge is still there, and I go every day that I can go to try to, I guess, not necessarily figure them out, but try to catch one. And, yes, I return them all. So I think there are parallels, very definitely parallels that are in there. And I hope that some young PhD students in wildlife management or in fish management in some of these areas would take some of the research that we've done, and if they couldn't do the complete package, I wish they would start taking pieces of it and do exactly what you're suggesting. Does this apply to other areas of sportsmanship and outdoorsmen? And I think it does.
So, yeah, I think so,
I hope
too.
It happens.
I think it does, too. As a confirmed muskie fisherman, I have to agree with you
100%. Yeah, right.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the call. And Larry in Prairie Farm, believe you have a question for us. Hi, Larry.
Yes, I actually just have a comment on the, you're talking about the different stages of hunting. Now, I've been teaching hunter safety for 18 years now.
Okay.
I relay those stages to the students
all
the time.
Yes.
I have a 27-year-old son and a 22-year-old son, and I can, without fail, say that they're between stages 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been hunting, well, the youngest one's been hunting for 10 years as soon as he became legal to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
What we find the most when we're out there is at the end of the day, we all relate our experiences. This year, it was related between seeing coyotes, turkeys, foxes. We had a couple of fawns come up by us and just visit us and just look at us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just relating those experiences, that was the fun part of it.
Yeah.
To me, and this year I hunt rifle and muzzleloader, and I never pulled the trigger once. Not that I didn't see 60, 65 deer.
Yeah.
It's just that I sat back and enjoyed it. I sat and watched them for a couple hours one day eat out in a cornfield and a couple of stalks of corn.
Yeah.
But I think the ethics or the those stages really have to be relayed down through the ages. I mean, if I can get something through to a student in the class and they can relate it to somebody else, that's where it's got to come from. Our hunting number of hunters is decreasing through the years, and it's continually go that way, and that's a concern for the sportsman that wants to get it out there. But I instilled that on my sons when they were younger, and I can, like I said, I can say that they're between 3 and 4 as well as I have been for a long time.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it, and I'm going to make two quick I never make a quick comment. I'll try here.
Okay.
Two things. First of all, one of the great privileges of doing this research was to have the opportunity to meet folks like you. We have had the opportunity, Bob and I did, to do workshops in many of the states. And the hunter ed instructor, I believe, is to a large part the future of hunting. And when I had an opportunity, and I, like I said, I've had many over the last 20 years, they are some of the most dedicated, and I believe, sportsmen that there are. And the mission that they accomplish is just needs to be appreciated more and more and more by more and more hunters. So, again, thank you very much for what you do, and it is incredibly important.
And we, as instructors, sure, I'm speaking for the whole group of us here, that we thank you for making those comments, because I believe it's very important. At one point, I travel 75 miles to go to the classes 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And we run an internet class for a weekend.
Yes.
The ones that can't make the weekly classes.
Right.
But that's just my dedication to it. And I think a lot of us, I would you know, be remiss to say that most of us probably are the same way, because there is no, it's all voluntary.
Yes. Yeah. And the interesting part about it is that you folks who do this this volunteer work, there's a real sameness amongst you throughout the entire United States, all dedicated to hunting, dedicated to youth, and dedicated to ethical hunting.
That's correct.
Yeah, and it really is. It's a phenomena. I really believe it's a phenomena.
Yeah.
Again, thank you very much for doing it.
And thank you.
Yeah,
thanks, Larry.
For
appreciation. And like I said, it's really got to be brought down through the generations. And I hope what my sons instill, I instill upon them, that they instill upon their children.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And thanks, Larry.
Yep. Thank you.
Let's hear from Leslie next in Preston, Minnesota. Leslie, hi.
Hi, guys. Boy, I'm just sitting here with a big smile on my face. I can relate to what everybody is saying. We've been hunting for 30 years in our family. My brother, I had five brothers that hunted it growing up, but I can't explain enough about when a kid gets out in the woods and is taught by a family that is ethical. That's a key word here. It's all like what is taught to you and how you first learn, I think, is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see it, Larry, instead of your garden show during the hunting season, I would love to see this guest you have on or others like him that focus on ethical hunting and ways that, you know, there's a lot of chances for people to get out and hunt if they just knew how to approach the landowner.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the bad hunters that ruin it for everyone, because everything that's been said, I can relate to, and I don't have to say it again, but I just want to focus on one point. While we're out on stand, ethically hunting and following the rules, we can see, and I think our situation is kind of unique, but we see bad hunters driving on the road. We bow hunt only, but you know, we're out there during the shotgun too. But they're driving around with their guns sticking out of the car, and you know, you just see so many things, and you see them shooting at a way too long of a shot, and you see legs blown off, and it's just like, what are they thinking? You know, they're definitely not. They're not even at stage one.
Right. Good point.
So it's just, I can't explain. You can't relate until you sit in a deer stand, and see what you see. And otherwise, unless you do it, you just can't understand why hunters love to hunt. But there's so much more to it. And then the kids grow up with the love of nature, respect of animals, more willing to conserve and be, you know, citizens of the world rather than just playing video games and more real things. So I praise your program and
thank
go
you,
for it.
Thank you, Leslie, and I'm sure Bob, you want to comment.
Yeah, Leslie, 4 out of 5 hunters come into hunting through family tradition, and we must understand that. It's a family phenomena that causes a tremendous connection amongst the family members who do it. So it's a positive family gathering kind of a situation. We talk to people, the only time they still get together is for the rifle season or for the deer season. I mean, family members travel for thousands of miles to be able to be together for that particular time because it's so significant to them. And then they would talk to us about how significant the mother and father or the grandmother or the grandfather, whoever it is that brought them into hunting, the aunt or the uncle, how important they were to them now as adults because they were involved with them as children. Absolutely. And again, that's a message we need to get out. It's a family phenomena that has tremendously positive implications for everybody who's involved in it. Yeah. And we are losing numbers, and so that is a major, major problem that we have to address.
Bill in Oshkosh, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Wonderful program, gentlemen. If I may make a couple of observations, I think that certainly support everything you said. One is there are outfitters out there and professionals in the business that know the difference between trophy hunters and hunters that really care about the game. One guide said to me, he said, I can really see you care about the game. I said, well, why? He said, well, because
when the animal had died, you reached over and ran your hands down, you know, through the fur and looked at him. He said, other guys are putting the tape on him before even, you know, they're even dead. But there is a group, Descartes, one comment, fishermen and hunters are exactly the same. That's my unbiased observation. but truly, there is a group that's answering this issue or trying to and doing, I think, quite well at it at the national level, that's trying to make more territory available to middle class and working people that have found it more and more difficult to hunt because of leases or urban sprawl, and that's fishing too. It's called the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation, I think, program. They're, the name of the guy that, is Jim Range, R-A-N-G-E, is the head lobbyist for it, and they put together some excellent coalitions with unions and other people that really represent the middle strata in America, and they're very much pro all these things, and they've attracted some big money. They run a very good and thousands and thousands of, I think thousands of affiliate groups at this point, from local, you know, small town hunting clubs to, as I said, unions. And I think they have a website under TRCP, or just look up Jim Range in Washington, and they can certainly tell you how to get onto it. But it's a very important organization that's trying to lobby nationally for just these things, and then building a coalition to really put pressure on the Department of Agriculture and Wildlife and other people to help, you know, and to work with ranchers and farmers to make it worth their while to open up their lands, not block management where you can overhunt, but, you know, to work out with ranchers programs in which the habitat is considered so they could take 10 deer hunters or 3 trout fishermen a week or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, that's my comment, and I'm wondering if you know about them.
Not, but I certainly appreciate what you're saying. And Theodore Roosevelt, you know, we have a lot to be thankful for, the fact that he was president of the United States and what he did for us as sportsmen. So appreciate very much the information.
Thank you very much for calling, Bill. I appreciate it very much. And Bob, I thank you very much for coming on today. It'd be fun to have you back and talk again sometime. We didn't get through a lot of your book,
right.
And I wouldn't mind having you back and doing this again.
I'd appreciate that.
In the meantime, the book is titled The Hunter, Developmental Stages and Ethics, and it's very reasonably priced, like about $10,
yeah,
I think.
Right.
And the publisher is Riverbend Publishing in Helena, Montana. So it's going to be available. You'll be able to get it. Go to any of your local bookstores online probably. You can order it online as well. Or just go to your local bookstore and you'll be able to get a copy. And certainly one that every hunter or every person who's thinking about hunting should take a look at. And I also think people who don't hunt, to help them better understand those who do, I think is well worth it. There's some interesting sections in there that we never got to, especially, you know, husbands and wives, one hunts and the other doesn't, you know, hunters versus non-hunters, thoughts about hunting. So we've got some more things to cover, and Bob, appreciate it very much having you with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Norton of Onalaska, Wisconsin, who is the author. He's actually studied with Bob Jackson. They researched 25 years hunters, and the results are found in this book, The Hunter, Developmental Stages and Ethics, and a lot of kind of interesting stories that he's got to tell, too, about his experiences and the experiences of other hunters. So appreciate him being with us, and we'll get him back. We'll do it again. Coming up, there are some new rules for invasive species classifications here in Wisconsin. We have 3 guests representing 3 different areas, and they'll be talking with us next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.